Thank you for listening to Psychedelic Parenting, a service of Awakening Families. If you like what you hear, consider a tax-deductible gift to this work through our fiscal sponsor, MAPS, or use one of our Amazon links when you're buying the things you need.
Want to share with their young people the grandeur and the glory that they are encountering.
What's really important is the felt presence of direct experience. We have to stop consuming our culture. We have to create culture. Create your own roadshow. Nexus of space and time, where you are now, is the most immediate sector of your universe.
Welcome once again to psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. With me today is a very special guest, Omar Thomas. Omar is one of the co-founders of the Five in the Dark Psychedelic Retreats at Myco Meditations, a amazing organization which I just signed on as a partner to, and I'm very excited to bring Omar here to tell his story to all of you today. Omar is a retired Army Ranger. He is also a father and a person in recovery from PTSD using psilocybin mushrooms. So we are very excited to have you on the show today, Omar. Thank you for being on Psychedelic Parenting.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So look, as we get started here, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you originally got interested in psychedelics as a treatment for PTSD?
Sure. I'll start with the military. I left the military back in 1998. With full realization that I was leaving kind of broken and battered both in mind and body. And I needed some sort of change or some sort of way to get a sense of myself. And I had used psilocybin in the past as a child, I guess I want to call myself recreationally. Mm-hmm. But I knew there was some promise there, at least for affecting the way I felt or thought about things. I ended up moving out west to Nevada with the idea of that I would either get better or not get better from my injuries suffered. And I found that by immersing myself out west with psilocybin, I was able to tackle some of the worst aspects of PTSD. It didn't happen overnight, but it was the beginning of a process anyway.
And what kind of healing did you find through that work?
I found that what I thought I was going in for had little to do with what I actually got, at least at first. I went in thinking about, you know, what I had in the front of my mind, PTSD wise and social anxiety issues and so forth. But what happened was, I got plunged into the pool of my past, you know, of, past hurts and my childhood and things that I thought were, negligible, not even important, but I found that even those things were part and parcel of the PTSD experience, that I was a whole, you know, a continuum, mm-hmm. so to speak. So mm-hmm. I couldn't fraction myself or separate myself. So I had to delve into all of it. And that's what psilocybin was able to do for me.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions I ask people involved in psychedelic work, and specifically with PTSD, I have asked before is, what do you think is the differentiation between someone who serves in the military and comes home with PTSD versus a person who comes home and does not suffer from PTSD?
I don't know exactly, but I do believe it has something to do with a foundation that's either well set to begin with or one that was shaky to begin with, and then having to deal with the particular pains that come with combat. Mm-hmm. I think some of us just have, you know, either an already messed with kind of a mechanism or one that can take the additional stress of combat, I think we have a point that we reach where we just are saturated, and combat doesn't allow for you to process or integrate any of the things that happen in real time. You just got to keep on. And that policy of bottling up experiences, putting them away for another time, is part of a bad process overall for dealing with things in general. It's like it like definitely stirs that up.
Yeah. My friend Emmanuel Sfirios, who's working on the movie MDMA, the movie, said that one of the things that he sees very regularly in people with PTSD is what he calls survivor guilt. Would you agree with that?
I would have to agree. I'm almost surprised how much I have to agree. Yeah, absolutely, man. Caught me off guard a little bit.
So tell me about how you first got interested in Eric's work with micro-meditations.
Well, after, a decade and a half almost of working alone on my own with sometimes, you know, with other vets and so forth, I wanted to find a place. You know, is there a place where people in my situation or like the guys I'm working with where we can go, you know, and get not necessarily counseling and therapy. I mean, we've got that. You know, the VA offers that all day, but in those, I hate to call them the circle jerk sessions, you know, we sit around and we retell stories in a way that does offer some benefit, but it just doesn't get at, it doesn't even, it does, the scenario doesn't afford the care that each individual needs, I don't think. And so in searching online for a place where we could go, I ended up coming across micro-meditations. Of course, it's the only place on the internet that I found at all, or in the world, it seems, to where anybody could go and engage in this kind of work. And, you know, the main thing here was legally. You know, that was the rub. You know, it had to be a thing we could do in a calm, safe, and secure type setting. And there was Eric, you know, off in paradise doing this very.
So tell us about this work that you've been doing with other vets.
Well, we're meeting at the Philadelphia VA. There were group sessions that are held, and we'd kind of hang around after, some of us, to discuss issues or guys that were in similar units or had similar stories and so forth. And, you know, I let one individual know what I had been doing for myself, and how much I'd been able to get past. You know, I'm never 100% out of the woods, but I mean, there's a big difference in going from not being able to open the door, you know, to go outside for fear of what may happen or may not happen, to getting on an airplane and traveling to Jamaica, you know, relatively comfortably, and meeting with larger groups than is usually comfortable, and involving and engaging, and all these things happened directly related to psilocybin. And I had to share that. I couldn't keep that to myself. You know, I don't own it. And after the first guy came back, he came to my home. We sat, you know, we held space for him, and he came out of that not changed, but with promise, with some sort of hope that, yeah, this was the right thing. If I could do this more, something, there's something to it, you know, and that started it pretty much. We, you know, once we had about three members to us, you know, the idea of doing, you know, five trigrams, of course, this Terrence McKenna's, all shot out to him, idea. Our idea was to get our five senses involved, you know, in the dark, to try to feel. Initially, you know, at some point we got to five of us in the dark, and we thought that felt kind of significant too, you know, but in any event, conceptually, the five trigrams isn't the most important thing to us, but it's grown into being at least a benchmark, or at least a point of conversation, a starting point, a talking point, or whatever. Guys use, you know, varying amounts from, whatever they're comfortable with, but our idea, you know, and I guess probably comes from being warriors or feeling like we've been warriors, is to kind of push it a bit. And we feel like we could get ourselves a little bit to places that are uncomfortable, because we've been to uncomfortable places, you know, and it's a kind of a twisted irony that the one thing we don't want is the thing we kind of have a stomach for, you know, in a manner. So, you know, that kind of, we found that we could go in, we could do some things, and we helped ourselves much more than. And we had a real good control group. You know, it was the VA group that we kept going back to.
Yeah.
We saw guys there that were not getting not making progress. Mm-hmm. You know, and it, you know, it just kind of hurts to be able to have this kind of secret advantage we feel and not be able to say it out to the larger group.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel something very similar in my life, you know, when I see, like, because I drive Lyft regularly around MSU campus, and when I see just all of these young people having what amounts to the default rite of passage for our culture, which is, you know, binge drinking as a freshman in college, and how different our culture could be if we had a safe, productive container for psychedelic experiences in our culture.
Oh, I agree. I couldn't imagine what life would have been like had I been exposed prior to the military, let's say.
you may know, have not gone into the military, perhaps.
How about that? Yes. Perhaps. Yeah, I would have found a different way to work for college. Absolutely.
To be a warrior, yeah. A different way to be a warrior. Well,
sure, I find being a dad qualifies quite nicely, too.
I agree, yeah. And, you know, from the being a warrior perspective, I have to give you pretty mad props for just seeing you handle your 5 grams on the beach last week.
I know.
just like be walking up and down the beach and barely sitting down. I was pretty impressed, man.
Well, I wasn't trying, but thank you.
You're welcome.
No, you know, it's part of our practice that we started developing this idea that rather than just be swept away by all that can happen, some of us found that we had kind of a little bit of a skill for standing what we call an onslaught, you know, first wave, second wave, third wave, kind of, you know, like a psychonauts that they will know what I mean, you know, of activity that comes. And we tend to hold a body posture, whether it's lotus or some comfortable meditative position, but that becomes our sort of position of power that we hold. Mm-hmm. For me, it's, you know, one hand to the ground and touching a knee, typically, you know, to remind myself to be grounded and to assuage my fears, or at least it gives me, it's hard to explain and put into words, but it, finding that power position, it's the one default we go back to when we find difficulty. And that's been a very useful thing for us. And in the psychedelic state, I've asked for a song, you know, to help deal with stress and problems that came up while on a trip, while dealing with some of the most difficult parts of the psychedelic trip in terms of processing the past and memories and so forth. And it's amazing what one can do in that state. It is not a helpless state.
Yeah.
You know, it's a state that requires submission to get the full effect. I call it bending the knee. We're going to bend it to something anyway, you know, but this is one place where you can come and do so and leave with your integrity. You don't feel like you've bent the knee. I mean, you know, you have gone through a process. You've been humbled, but you don't feel abused. Yeah. You know, you understand that it was good medicine and good for you. So.
Right. Yeah. And I find that sometimes, not all the time, that the most challenging experiences that I have are the ones that when I finally integrate them and move on to the next thing, that those are the ones that were the most, had the most growth in them, I guess you could say, that I did the most real work and I evolved the most coming out of them.
Yeah, absolutely. We've grown to just realize that there were no bad trips.
Yes.
That was literally a point of view, usually fear-based, you know, or a lack of understanding-based. But once we could understand or process or integrate the stuff from the more difficult trips, you got it right on the head. That is where the stuff is. You know, that's where it's like mining for gold. You got to move a lot of earth, you know, to get to the stuff. And, you know, I love that there's this powerful earth moving tool, you know, that's here and has been here. So.
One of the things that I think is interesting listening to your talk that I pick up on is, you are definitely one of the most humble people that I've met in a while. And I'm really interested in the way that you speak collectively about your work in Five in the Dark and with your brothers in arms, and how, you know, it almost sounds like you're reading from the big book, from the AA book, how like, it's like, we, you know, felt powerless. We did this. It's a very, you know, you have a very strong sense of like collaboration and collective energy. And I am very excited for the ways that you and I and Eric will be collaborating together in the coming months and years. Very, very excited for that.
Yeah, likewise, I'm excited too. As far as, you know, one thing that combat teaches is that no one does anything alone. You know, very few real heroes out there are heroes by themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's a team effort. So that lended itself naturally to the way this group kind of got together. It was always a we. There's no leader. There's no head. There's no need. You know, we share in information. We share in integration. We share in our lives for the most part, you know, because we've grown through this. It's like a sense of family emerges out of wherever this stuff happens.
Yeah. I would totally agree with that. Yeah,
I've been able to bring that same team approach to our work, you know, at Micah Meditations and Five in the Dark and so forth, because the understanding is that each of us are working for a greater good anyway, a larger good. So that's really the playbook. You know, there is a greater good, but all of our individual and collective needs can be met. And I think we can demonstrate that to a larger audience and the world, you know, that we are upright members of society, that we are warriors, and some of us broken, and all of us broken, you know, to some degree.
Yeah.
We're fruitful and active members in our societies, you know, and psychedelics aid in that process. They don't detract. They don't take away from it. I mean, proper use, of course.
Yeah. So let's talk about set and setting. If someone is listening to this and they are a veteran suffering from PTSD, looking to heal themselves, how would you recommend them getting started with psilocybin?
Well, at this point, you know, I'd say call Micah Meditations.
Yeah.
And come out for a retreat. Absolutely. Short of that, I would say, you know, give me a call or get in contact with like-minded people. Go on the forums, get online, get involved, you know, locally, speak out, especially if psychedelics aren't currently in your life, but you would like them to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have the First Amendment. We can ask pointed questions. We can attempt to get a dialogue started on multiple levels and multiple venues, and be heard. Let people know that we're out here and that we are not, you know, just small pockets of people who don't care.
Mm-hmm.
That we do connect using social media and using all of the various human ways of interacting, you know, the most natural ways of we're here, you know, and we are actively working to combat the things and the problems that ail society, point blank. I'll just put it out there, because by helping to fix ourselves, we are helping the all. So the team approach is the only approach, you know, going forward for us.
Yeah. So your first retreat with Micah Meditations, you brought your son along.
Absolutely.
And so tell me what that was like, having that experience at Treasure Beach with your son.
Well, it was wonderful. It was beautiful. It was all the things you and I know it to be, or can be. But to watch him handle himself, I guess I felt pride, you know, for all my, you know, I would love to feel humble, but at that moment, man, I was caught up in the idea that this, my young man, has chosen to take a step that's missing for many young people, which is that rite of passage you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to be a part of it and initiate it and watch him go through that archway, come out the other side and say to me, "Dad, yes, that was the right thing to do. And I understand why it's helped you. I understand why you've done what you've done or had to do," and so forth. So, and he's totally supports the work and envisions himself facilitating, you know, one day in a larger setting.
Very cool. That is very exciting. I'm very much looking forward to meeting him maybe sometime this spring or summer.
I hope so.
So how do you see, what do you see as your primary role in Micah Meditations?
Facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
Primary role is to sit with individuals that struggle, to sit with people who don't think that there's a way, and to show them through basically, and it's ironic what can happen, how powerful it is holding space for someone There's an energetic exchange where, you know, the facilitators are altered by the experience.
Yeah.
And I've walked away with so much. It's almost a selfish thing to sit for someone because, you know, it's well, sorry, not selfish, but there's a give and take. We're both gaining during the experience, the facilitator and the person going in, because trust is at the heart of the entire thing. These individuals come in, they're in a vulnerable place, and doubly so because they've come with issues.
Yeah.
You know, and not that we provide answers, but to be able to hold a safe and what I consider sacred space.
Yes.
For an other and others' issues, that is what society needs. It is an antidote, you know, to at least some of what's going on, a large chunk of it, I think.
Yeah.
So this rite of passage, I'm glad to have been able to have it in my son's life. And I want to see more sons on the beach with fathers, more daughters with mothers, more families, you know, because it's the antidote.
Mm-hmm. One question that I usually ask of my guests is, how old is old enough?
Well, if I think back to some of what I know from ayahuasca and other ritual plants and so forth, culturally, there's a taboo, but I've been one to kind of break with culture where culture didn't suit my reality.
Yeah.
And my reality is one of what's best for myself and my family and every other family that I come in contact with, you know, because there's a best version of me for all of that contact as well. So trying to cultivate, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question anymore, but trying to cultivate proper, you know, right thought, right speech, right action, you know, in the Buddhist sort of mindset is what this brings to everybody. Now, did I miss your question?
Well, what I meant was how old is old enough for a young person to have this experience?
I think it's a family decision. You know, it's not one that a child can make on their own. It's for us, I can say that it has been a collective with the person who makes the decision. The final decision is with the individual. You know, in my son's case, he personally feels an inner conviction that this is the right work for him. This is after having a proper initiation. I think a familial context, you know, and definitely in the conversation should be the idea of rite of passage, the idea of crossing over from one way of viewing the world into another way of viewing the world with an additional set of tools, an additional voice to assist in doing so. So absolutely, a family decision, but I, you know, it is a tricky question, you know, kind of at its core, but I would say that based on the safety of psilocybin in particular, if a child is psychologically developed enough to ask the right questions and handle the answers, you may be on your way to having a child that is potentially a good candidate for use, you know, but without the right dialogue and context in place, you know, I would say it's very, very, very situation specific and it's a family decision, you know, but I have no issues personally with a young teenager. My personal feeling, puberty, you know, is a decent time to help someone learn to adjust and deal with puberty. You know, transitional phases are really good points at which to assist an individual. And this society doesn't offer very much assistance in that way anymore. So, that's my answer. Very long.
Yeah. And I would say late middle school, early high school is really the time in our culture when the ego really starts to kind of get its talons into you as a person. And there's so many questions and, you know, who am I and all that stuff comes up anyway.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it seems to me though, that's accelerating a little bit, you know, even younger and younger, I'm finding kids with identity situations. I didn't mean to cut you off, but you know, our other daughter was discussing issues with her friends at school. So our one child who is in the public school system still. And when I hear some of the things that are happening at 10, 11, and 12th grade, I'm sorry, 12 years old, I'm really, really wondering, you know, that it gives a whole other take to your question as to how young. Mm-hmm. If they're young enough or old enough to handle the stresses of body dysmorphia and all of the other things that are coming at them much earlier in life, you know, mm-hmm. I'm almost tempted to want to say, you know, as early as you think is necessary, you know, as early as the first signs appear that something's left of center, or, you know, because it comes, you know, puberty brings the stresses that it brings anyway. Mm-hmm. But it's a really great time for the family to come together rather than fracture. Mm-hmm. You know, that's it, man.
I agree. Totally agree. How would you describe your son's experience on the beach? How would you say that it differed from your own experimentation with psychedelics as a youth?
I would say that he approached psychedelics with an unencumbered spirit. I saw me without the problems is what it looked like. He was completely playful. Mm. He was in a good place relative to nature and himself. He was figuring that out, that he was a piece of that all, you know, and watching him do that is magic. It's just magic.
Right on. So you also homeschool your son. Tell us about what made you arrive at the decision to do that.
Well, just delving a little deeper into my personal psychology here. It's an idea that I have that he is mine, but not mine. I made a vow when he was born that I would not do things the way they were done to me, mm-hmm. whatever that meant. So at first the template was just doing the opposite of what I got, but that is just a good starting point. You know, a healthier template is one where I'm not focusing on the opposite of what I want, but I'm focusing on all the right things, mm-hmm. you know, and transitioning over to doing things the right sort of way was the idea behind homeschooling him as I'm considered a disabled vet. I have the time to be at home with him. So the choice was really an easy one as I went through my own health issues and rehab and so forth, mm-hmm. that while I had the time, I was going to do it as much as I could. I wanted immersion. I didn't want separation. I wanted anything that would make me a part of the everyday, you know, not just a service provider, you know, as parents feel like they are. Yeah. I wanted it. You know, and homeschooling seemed like a really good way to not so much undo anything from the past, but just to establish a new track mm-hmm. for us to ride down, you know, that was just based on a new sort of paradigm and relationship. And it has been a beautiful thing to again have him. I did let him go through to second grade, mm-hmm. You know, some basics in on his own and the bit of socialization and so forth. But it was just a matter of, it seemed like the right time. He was really agreeable to it. Mm-hmm. And it has taken off. He's 15 now, mm-hmm. and he's doing higher level studies, mostly on his own. Mm-hmm. Been studying Japanese for 2.5 years.
Wow.
You know, way into drone technology. I mm-hmm. could imagine him building them. And he certainly loves taking things apart. But mm-hmm. the person that's emerged is someone I fear I would have not seen had I not taken the drastic, well, seemingly drastic at the time, you know, step of deciding to pull him from the system and put him into a context where his personal needs be met 100%, you know, without competition, mm-hmm. at least for a little while. It was never the idea that it'd be forever or for long term. We had no idea, but it has grown every year. It's been more and more a joy. You know, trying to keep pace with the curriculum that the state puts out is kind of neat too, because I get to poke holes in all of it and fill those holes all at the same time, which is a pretty neat thing to be able to go through. But
yeah,
I love it. Good.
Yeah, public school curriculum these days is very much like teach to the test and lowest common denominator, and it doesn't really offer the best environment for people who are unusual. So let's talk about Five in the Dark and its relationship to micro-meditations. We were talking before we started the recording about how you see Five in the Dark as being a forum for a one-on-one experience for folks. What we did at last week when we were in Jamaica together is we did a number of group experiences on the beach, which I found to be amazing environment. It's the landscape there, the ocean, the beach, the neighborhood is transformative. The dark sky and the stars, transformative in and of itself. I mean, just the first night we were there, we were sitting and none of us took any medicine and we just hung out and just watched and sat for people. But just to be there in that space was in some ways a transformative psychedelic experience. But it can be an overwhelming, this, you know, the vastness of the sky and the ocean and the openness of the environment can be, if someone is you know, suffering from extreme anxiety or other such things, you know, being in a more clinical setting can be better for them. So talk about what Five in the Dark retreats can do for people that need more structure or more of a clinical setting.
Oh, absolutely. It was born out of the sessions that we were doing here. Mm-hmm. The idea that for some folks, a group setting just isn't the best way for them to get the most help out of a session. That sometimes a closed loop, as we call them here, you know, sort of session where we have a one-on-one clinical time where folks can feel the awesomeness of the inner journey without having to also take in the awesomeness of the spectacle of the setting. Mm-hmm. that can often overwhelm just because it's so profound, you know, and transformative in and of itself. Totally. The setting. This is just another way of controlling the set and setting in a way that literally controls the variables. That's the best way of putting it, you know. Mm-hmm. No bugs that no one expects, you know, the crawl across or the buzz past the ear and so forth. Just the right lighting, the right mood, and again, the bond between the individual going in and the sitter is able to be maximally utilized. Mm-hmm. You know, in that small or closed setting.
Yeah.
I find, you know, it's just a lot of times it's end of life issues, you know, don't get handled very well in a large group setting, you know, difficult diagnoses that people are trying to process. Sometimes, you know, the one-on-one approach is best for people like that. And so we thought that it's best to make this option available so that for those, you know, suffering or thinking that one-on-one's for them, we've got that covered as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Touching back on this idea that the facilitator is as much transformed by an experience as the person going into the experience, you know, I had my experience in Jamaica with you guys was in some ways a culmination and a justification for so much personal suffering that I've encountered in the last 6 or 8 months, just doing my own work and processing through my issues with gender identity and, you know, just who am I and what am I doing and what's my purpose. And I just, it literally felt to me like that our last night on the beach, if you had gone home a little bit early and we had a really powerful experience on the beach that's Monday night. And I sat very intimately for one of our retreatants. And it felt like all of the work that I had done over the last 6 months and all the suffering and all the confusion, it felt like all of that stuff was like I was being forged in a fire to be the person that I needed to be at that moment for that person. And it felt like everything in my life, like came together, clicked, snapped like a Lego set or something. And it's like, all of a sudden I was like, yes, I finally understand why I had to deal with all of this shit for this moment.
You sound like a guy with a calling.
I think that would be an accurate assessment. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, there is an energetic field. This is my theory, my working theory on this. Mm-hmm. An energetic field established. You know, I think it's not something visible, but to be in that sacred space, you know, you know it once you're in it, and it's harder to describe if you've never been in it. Mm-hmm. You know, but to be changed by what's required of you, to facilitate for someone, you've got to be out of your own way.
Yeah.
You've got to be available. And that's emotionally, cognitively, you can't be the kind of person who doesn't have time for others. So basically it brings out the best in you. In doing so, a cycle is initiated where the best is sort of brought out of both of you or all of the members involved, you know, in a session. And it's trying to capitalize on the phenomenon that are natural. It's really what this is all about. You know, there's a natural flow of energy between persons and peoples, and there are blockages to that energy, you know, again, my theory on it, and facilitating, we can often help with that flow based on our experience. You know, the fact that we've been in that same space so many times, you know, affords us the real working knowledge of what they're going through, a real sense of what it is to come face to face with oneself and one's issues and so forth. And yeah, a bond is forged that can be lifelong. You know, yeah. It doesn't have to be, and often it isn't, but it certainly could be if one wanted it to be. Yeah. And that's a beautiful feeling, you know, all its own.
Indeed. Yeah. I remember like saying to the person that I was holding space for, I said, you realize now that we're going to be friends forever.
Yeah.
You know, I also did a one-on-one that week too, with one of our retreatants. And, I remember her saying to me, we were kind of in the coming down phase for her. And we were sitting on the porch of the little cabana where we did the experience. And, she had said something along the lines of like, she apologized for taking up my whole day. And wasn't I bored just sitting there, you know, just waiting for her? And I said, on the contrary, there's no place on earth that I would rather be right now. And I've never felt more content than I do in this moment.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. It's an honor.
It is an honor. It is. And it's so funny that the things that like you, it's, you know, the spinning of your mind that can happen when you're just idle and sitting normally, it's just like all that stuff is just not there. It just fades away and you're just focused on the needs of this person and, you know, being receptive for them. And, you know, do they need a hand to be held? Do they need some water to drink? Do they need a reassuring voice? I mean, I feel like half of what we do as facilitators is just say, you're doing a great job. Don't worry. Everything's fine. Keep going deeper, you know?
I agree. But what in hearing you describe it, it says to me, I'm listening to a guy who's saying, you're describing what everyone ought to be doing for everyone anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we are putting into practice in a very basic and real way, right action, you know, and right behavior towards each other. And I think that's the real foundation for a lot of the work that gets done. Mm-hmm. It's that people feel safe, you know, without that feeling of safety, it's difficult to get anything done,
right?
You know, and it's a loop, you know, we almost don't have a choice anymore. And that's a good thing. You know, that's what a calling, I guess, feels like.
Yes.
You know, that you would not be doing anything else given a choice, you know, and I certainly, have been chosen as far as I'm concerned. You know, I don't know by what or whom, maybe it's just me,
I think it's totally true.
You know, I'm all in and I couldn't do anything else. You know, this is the way.
Yeah.
It really is.
And it's interesting too, if, you know, for me, it really feels like it feels like with both of you guys, it's like picking up where we left off. It doesn't feel like a new relationship. It feels like this is something, you know, I'm not sure if I believe in reincarnation or not, but it kind of feels like this is something we've done before. You know what I mean? It just feels like, yeah, this is getting the band back together, maybe.
What I do know is I know when I feel like home with another person.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I felt almost immediately meeting both of you, but, you know, meeting you most recent. Mm-hmm. I got to say, you know, you got the goods.
And I would say that's the feeling is mutual there, man. The feeling is mutual.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it.
Yeah. What do you think is the most important thing that you've learned from your psychedelic work?
That we are all equipped to be our own best counselors. Maybe not right away, but we're still the best equipped. We know ourselves. And if we can get a few things out of the way, a few misperceptions about ourselves out of the way, we can then typically begin to delve into some of the things that that won't misdirect us, that are a bit more solid and need our actual attention. Mm. I think being able to identify the spots where we get blocked and stuck, and then becoming unstuck through a natural flow of, I'm not talking about anything unnatural or unusual, but through the natural way in which we deal with stress, in terms of having to sit with it, literally handle it, and let it pass through us. I think that is integral. That's also what's missing in society. We tend to run and escape into potions, bottles, pills, and tinctures, and which is kind of ironic. We're saying, you know, hey, consume this product, but it is the very antithesis of escape.
Yes.
You know, it's literally the idea of I'm going in to face reality, not escape reality, and that is the significant paradigm shift, you know, yeah. that psychedelics, especially the plant-based psychedelics, afford, as far as, you know, my personal opinion.
Yeah, and it's interesting too when we're talking about as we're giving people guidance and preparation for their first experience on the beach. The number one rule is don't run.
I don't want to chase.
Yeah, don't run across the beach. Don't run and don't run from yourself and from your interior experiences. And historically, I've described that to people as say yes to what's ever in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear. To me, it's bend the knee, you know, submit in a manner of speaking. I mean, yes. You've already submitted to depression and to anger and to whatever has brought you to this particular point. Mm-hmm. You know, I just try one more submission. You know, I've said to people, just sit still with this and say yes, like you said, you know, and just watch the difference that saying yes to this can make.
Yeah.
You know, you can say yes to a lot of things, but not too many things are going to give you the good look in the mirror that we need to grow up, you know, to really grow up and love, to grow up and be open, to grow up and be vulnerable, grow up and be sensitive. You know, to me, that's all what growing up really means, to grow up, to be open. Yes, you're open to being hurt as well, but, you know, that is part and parcel of this life.
Yeah.
To be able to take, handle all of that goodness and all of what can also come, it's not so good. And balance it out, because balance is really the key. People are trying to find a balance in their lives. And psilocybin in a controlled and guided environment has been instrumental and life-changing. And more people are getting on board.
Indeed. So for one last question I'd like to ask you. Of the work that you've done with veterans and in the retreats at Micro Meditations, what would you say, can you tell us a story without using names of the most interesting or transformative experience you've seen someone have?
There was a young man from Europe who came in and really, really anxious about social situations. And he showed up the very first day of a 10-day retreat, and, you know, quiet, almost unwilling to engage or speak with anyone. And I got to watch him unfold, you know, as the days went on. And he's a really good friend now, as a matter of fact. You know, we keep in contact online, and we constantly text each other. He's a good guy, and he needed to know that. You know, he needed to feel good with himself and appreciate himself, and to be able to sit and watch a guy go from, I wouldn't say cold, but a bit standoffish, you know, to warm and able to crack jokes in an open social setting in a group. You know, we everyone there watched, you know, as lights went on inside of each of us, you know, over various issues and things that came up. But yeah, he really stood out for me because it was more than theory. Mm-hmm. It was happening in front of our eyes. You know, so that was inspirational to me, that if a guy who could come in so twisted and not could leave, you know, less twisted, with sense of purpose and a mission once he left, that he was going to do X, Y, or Z for himself. You know, that's what it's all about for me.
Indeed. And, you know, I'd like to leave people with the thing is about micro meditations is that, you know, you can read these articles in the New Yorker and the Atlantic and talking about the research that's being done at Hopkins and NYU and other places. And the fact is that, like, this medicine exists, and it's not just this sort of, you know, it's not just like a testing pharmaceutical that's out there. I mean, the medicine is available to people. And that's the reason why we're doing this work in Jamaica, where we don't have to be as so concerned about the DEA and Controlled Substances Act and all this stuff. Like, we can go there where it's legal and it's safe, and we can help people right now, because the people that are coming to these retreats are not, for the most part, you know, just psychonauts or spiritual seekers or people looking for a good time. These are people that, you know, like Hopkins studies have shown that psilocybin helps to treat addiction. It helps to treat end of life anxiety. And we're seeing people coming to us that have stage 4 cancer and just want to feel better about, want to have like a better quality of life for what they've got left, or they're trying to quit smoking, or they're trying to get off alcohol, or they're suffering from anxiety or OCD. And we're seeing people fly home healing. And
yeah,
it's like, we don't want to wait for people to get the relief that's, you know, I feel like that nature has for them available.
I agree with you. This is our birthright. This is a product of the planet Earth as we are. Mm-hmm. And, to have a safe, legal environment where you can go and find the natural plant medicines to address what ails you is a gift.
Yes.
And I'm proud and honored to be able to offer the services we offer at Micah Meditations. I'm proud to be able to sit. And I say to anybody with the wherewithal or the desire to come out and to see what it's all about, I encourage them to do so. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really good work happening. Get online, get educated, find out what's happening. You know, psilocybin is not a dirty word. Psychedelics are not, it's not a dirty word, yeah. You know, and some really good things are happening in the world. This is not an isolated incident. People have been benefiting for thousands of years. We've got a propaganda problem, not a psilocybin problem.
Yes, totally. Certainly. So, brother, I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show today. I look forward to deeper and deeper collaboration and friendship with you. And I'm so excited for what is going to be happening in the future, and so excited for all of the people that we are going to get to help. I just would encourage people to check out mycometitations.com. and 5inthedark.com to see what's we've got going on in Jamaica, Treasure Beach. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth, and I've been to a lot of places, and that beach is heaven on earth.
Do yourself a favor, come on out.
Indeed. So this has been Omar Thomas, founder of 5inthedark and a facilitator along with myself at Myco Meditations Psilocybin Retreats. Thank you so much for being on the show, Omar.
Thank you for having me, man.
Bye-bye. All right, man. We'll see you on the beach.
Take care, brother.
All right, bye.
My advice is to learn from your children, and perhaps eventually, when you're spiritually ready, you'll turn on with your children if you think that's the right thing to do.
Your friends and your associations.